Okay, maybe we can start. So the themes for tonight's talk is going to be something, I think, reasonably profound. Hopefully that will be interesting for you. It's going to be about aspects of something known as dependent origination, which is a very well-known teaching of the Buddha's. Can you hear me okay? Just making sure this works properly. Okay. So it's going to be on this teaching known as dependent origination, which is a very core teaching of the Buddha. And it is often considered to be a very profound teaching. And I think that is true. And this is actually referred to in the suttas itself as being very profound. You may have heard this story before. There is a very quite a well-known event in the suttas. Where Venerable Ananda is the Buddha's main attendant, and he goes to the Buddha and he says to the Buddha, this dependent arising, this dependent origination is profound, and it appears profound, and yet to me it is as clear can be. That's what he says. And the Buddha replies, do not say so, Ananda, do not say so. This dependent arising is profound, and it appears profound. It is because of this dependent arising that people are not freed from suffering, freed from samsara in this world. Right? So this is straight from the sutta known as the sutta is a discourse, known as the great sutta on causation. And the Buddha is basically saying to Venerable Ananda, listen, Venerable Ananda, listen, Ananda, you may think you understand this fully, but actually you don't. Right, this is Venerable Ananda, this is one of the Buddha's main disciples who says he hasn't got the full understanding of this. Okay, can you hear me, everybody? Is it getting better? Yeah, okay. A bit noise. What was that? Yeah, it's, I think they're working on it, so probably probably happening soon, so hopefully it will be okay, yeah. Okay, so the point here is that it is obviously a very profound teaching. And of course, sometimes you think, oh, if Venerable Ananda couldn't understand it, how am I going to understand it, right? He was one of the great disciples of the Buddha. But that would be the wrong way of looking at these teachings. Because with so many things in Buddhism, there are so many different levels of understanding this. And when you approach these teachings in the beginning, you start to understand them at a certain level. And as time goes by, you start to appreciate these teachings more and more, and you start to get a grasp of the profundity of these teachings. But the other thing about this teaching, as I said, it is an important teaching of the Buddha. How do you know something is important? This is, I think, another thing to reflect on. Very often we are told that certain teachings are important, but actually how do we know that? Do we know that because somebody tells us? Or is there a more objective approach to deciding which teachings actually really matter? And the answer is that there is a fairly objective way, and that objective way is to read the discourses of the Buddha, and as you read them, you will see that there are certain things that are repeated again and again to different audiences, different people, different places, right? And as you understand that this teaching is being repeated so often in all kinds of situations, sometimes with slight variations, right? This is one of those amazing skillful means of the Buddha, this ability to take the same teaching, give it a slight variation, and then when you see the slight variation, suddenly something clicks, because a slight variation gives you a slightly different angle, and that is what actually enables you to appreciate that teaching. We all come from these things from slightly different angles, and for that reason it is so important that the Buddha does just that. So I would recommend you, if you're ever interested in reading the discourses of the Buddha, those discourses that really matter are those that are repeated again and again. Those are by far the most important ones. And dependent arising is one of those teachings. So what is this dependent arising? Many of you will know what this is about because you've been around here for a long time. Some of you may have probably no idea at all, right? What's this dependent origination? What a strange name for a teaching, you probably think. And it is a little bit strange, but nevertheless, it is important. So I think it's a very good opportunity to get at least some feel for this is about. Essentially what it is about a series of 12 factors, each factor being linked to the one that comes after it, right? So starting with one factor, and because of that factor, the next one arises. And because the next one arises, the third one arises. And so it goes all the way to the 12th factor in this series. Each factor leading to the next one is what you might call a series of sufficient conditionality. Some other more big words, right? But sufficient conditionality just means that when one factor is present, the one after it must happen as a consequence. And so it goes all the way through this chain of 12 links. And to understand this fully, again, is very profound. But by looking at the ends of this chain, starting from the beginning and looking at the last one, you get a feeling for what this is all about. The very first factor of dependent origination is called in the Pali language avijja. And avijja basically means something like, is often translated as ignorance into English. It may not be perhaps the perfect translation. It's hard to translate these things absolutely accurately. Ignorance, delusion is another way of looking at it. Misunderstanding is another way. Wrong view is perhaps another way, right? Basically, it means you don't really have a proper grasp of reality. You're not seeing the world as it actually is. That is what it means to have avijja. You're blind, you're obscured. You're not seeing things quite right, the right way. So this is the beginning point of this thing, right? And the Buddha says, people generally have this quality of avijja, this inability to see the world as it actually is. Now, at the other end point of this sequence of 12 factors, you find what is called in Pali, dukkha. Heard of dukkha before? I'm sure many, many of you have. For those of you who haven't, it's one of the most fundamental and important teachings in Buddhism. Dukkha means something like suffering, in unsatisfactoriness, right? The idea that life isn't as perfect as we would like it to be, often far more imperfect than we actually are able to even acknowledge. So suffering is at one end, and at the other end, at the beginning of that sequence, is a misunderstanding. So what this whole teaching means is that if you don't have a proper grasp of reality, if you don't understand the world as it actually is, it means the consequence of that is that there will be suffering in your life. That's what it means, right? And that is the main purpose of this dependent arising, is to show you what the root problem is, why it is that we suffer at the end of the day. Why is it that we have all these tragedies and problems in the world, right? In family life, in society at large, in our personal life. Why is it that no without suffering, every day there are little problems? And the root reason for that is because of avijja, misunderstanding, ignorance, delusion. So this is what this whole teaching is about. Now, this teaching is so complex, there's so many factors to it, that this is only the main overview of this teaching. But also, because of the complexity of this thing, it also touches on many other things. And one of the things that this shows is, many of you will know about the Buddhist idea of anatta. Anatta means non-self, right? The idea that there is no abiding essence in any kind of being. Now this sequence also shows you how it is possible that this sequence can go on, keep on going, without an abiding self inside of us. Most people, when they hear about the Buddhist idea of rebirth, the first thing will say, if you believe in rebirth, you must believe in a self, because without a self, it's impossible to have rebirth. There must be something which sustains this process, right? When you go from one life to the next one, and that has to be the self, this permanent entity inside of you. But no, says the Buddha, that just shows that you are already biased. It shows that you don't have the imagination to understand that this whole process that we're going through all the time can happen without an abiding essence or sense of self inside of us. This is the other thing that this shows, right? Now you start to see how profound this actually is. There's a lot of information. I'm sure for many of you, you have read those 12 things and you kind of look at them and you think, makes a little bit of sense. Perhaps doesn't make sense, not really sure what it means. But to actually draw out all these points is quite difficult. And it takes a lot of careful attention and careful understanding to be able to draw all of these things out of this teaching. Yeah? But the third aspect, which comes out very clearly in Dependent Arising, and this is the aspect I want to focus on tonight, and that is the idea of karma. You know, the Buddhist idea of karma, the idea that when you do certain acts, when you act in certain ways, it will have results. The basic idea is that if you act with a bad motivation, it will produce bad results. If you act with a good motivation, it will produce good results. That's the basic idea of karma. But sometimes it sounds a bit like magic, right? Okay, you do something good, you get something good in return. Why is that? What is there a mechanism here? How does this actually work? Does it, you know, how come that if I just do good, I get all these good results? And it isn't necessarily obvious. And sometimes it may seem like magic when you first hear about it. And many people don't believe this, right? But actually, this is where dependent origination comes in very handy, because it shows us very clearly how this mechanism actually functions. Why is it that when you do something bad, you get bad results? Why is it that when you do something good, you get good results? And I say it is very useful to understand that, because when you, the more understanding you have of this mechanism, the more you can relate it to your own life, the more easy it is to apply it, right? When you see it happening inside of yourself, when you can relate to this, of course, it is much easier to apply it as a consequence. So this is not just theoretical. I don't think purely theoretical teachings are all that interesting. Teachings should be applicable, right? Something we can apply in our own lives. Only then do they have real meaning. Pure philosophy is better left to the universities than to the spiritual path. So what is this all about then? What is this connection? So to understand this, I'm going to have to look, I will be looking this evening at the first four factors of this dependent arising. And as I said before, the very first factor is avijja, which means not seeing things according to reality. The second factor is called, in Pali, is called sankhara. And sankhara means something like the creative activity, right? It refers to the intention, the volition inside of us, the things that kind of are moving us in life, right? What is it that moves you in life? What moves you is the agency inside of you who says, now you must do this, now you must choose in that particular way. This is the second factor, this agency, especially coming from the mind itself, and then expressing itself also through body and speech. That's the second factor, right? So what it is saying here, this dependent origin, what it is saying is that if you have avijja, sankhara must happen as a consequence. If you don't see the world as it actually is, you will start this agency, this doing process, as a consequence of that. I will explain this in a second, what this actually means, because this is still a bit theoretical. And then as a consequence of that, you then, because of all this agency, all this doing, this affects your mind. And how it affects your mind, this is the important thing for understanding the mechanism of karma itself. This is the third factor in dependent origination, called vijnana. Vijnana means consciousness. It also refers to the mind. Your mind is directly affected by the agency, by your intentions, by your volition, by your aims, your purposes, your goals in life. All of these things affect your mind in a direct way. I find this very exciting myself. I just talked about this over quite a bit recently, and I really, really enjoy this particular thing, because it seems so, it's so enjoyable sometimes when you get a little bit of insight into how these things work. So what is, let us go back then to the very first factor here. Avijja, ignorance, not understanding things according to reality. What does this mean? Now, the way this is usually defined in the discourses of the Buddha, defined as not understanding the Four Noble Truths. Four Noble Truths may be one of the most core teachings of Buddhism, right? Noble Truth of Suffering, Noble Truth of the Origin of Suffering, the Ending of Suffering, and the Path Leading to the End of Suffering. Four Noble Truths. Some people say, oh, Buddhism is so pessimistic, all about suffering, terrible. But actually, the point, of course, is that if you understand suffering, you understand happiness, right? Happiness and suffering are two sides of the same coin. So it's not really pessimistic at all. Suffering, you understand happiness. So you can turn those four truths into the four noble truths of happiness, if you like, instead. Now, for the purposes of dependent origination, the most important aspect of these four noble truths, I think, is the first one itself, the idea of suffering. And the Buddha says, we don't understand the Four Noble Truths. It means that we don't really appreciate suffering and happiness. We don't really have a good understanding of what suffering and happiness are in this world, in our own life. We don't know where to find real happiness. We don't know how to avoid suffering properly because of the deluded state of our mind, because of our lack of grasp on reality. So what that means is, if we believe that happiness is to be found in a certain place, right? And we don't understand how suffering is to be avoided, right? If we believe we understand happiness and suffering, it means that we will go out into the world and pursue those things. If you think you know what happiness is, what are you going to do? You're going to pursue that happiness, right? It's a natural consequence of thinking that you understand these things. So once you have this delusion that you know where suffering and happiness is to be found, you act upon that. You aim to find that happiness in the world. You intend to find the happiness. You will to find that happiness. You choose, right? You make this choice rather than that choice because you think this choice will give me happiness. So this is how misunderstanding, the lack of understanding of reality, gives rise to this agency which goes out searching for happiness in the world, acting to create that happiness in this life and also in future lives. Right? It's very obvious when you think about it. This is so far very theoretical, but just think about your life. Right? Think about your life. Think about the decisions that you make every day. Think about the big decisions in your life, like choosing a partner in your life. What kind of partner do you choose in your life? Do you choose some miserable person who's going to make you miserable? Or do you choose somebody who think you're going to make your life happy? It's going to make you feel good. You're going to have a good time together. You're going to enjoy life together. How do you make any choices in life? Any choice is always made on the basis of moving towards more happiness, right? And this is true for everything we do. From the moment you wake up in the morning, you dress yourself, or you choose your breakfast, the kind of job you have in life, the kind of entertainment that you enjoy, everything is based on this very simple idea. We want to find fulfillment, happiness, satisfaction, contentment. We want to move away from suffering. Sometimes it's not even finding happiness, just avoiding suffering, right? But it's the same idea. Whether it's avoiding suffering or finding happiness, it's the same thing. So this is what life is all about. And this is why we act. We think we know where to find happiness, and then we act in accordance with that. And of course, you will notice that it is almost always about the future. We're always searching, always going after this, always about something, somewhere on the horizon. We haven't got there quite yet, but we're moving towards it all the time. And of course, you keep on moving, life after life, right? Going on and on and on. But still, the delusion persists. Eventually, I will get there. I will find some happiness in my life. So this is a connection here between avidya and sankhara, between not understanding reality and then the agency arising, pursuing that happiness that you think is there, but that actually almost everybody is at least a little bit deluded about. Now, when you make choices in life, these choices that, you know, where you are pursuing happiness and things, those choices that you make, sometimes they can be choices. These choices can be based on two things. They can be based on bad motivations or good motivations. Right? For example, if you go out and somebody is nasty towards you, sometimes you get angry and you become nasty back. If you are nasty back, that's a bad motivation, right? So sometimes in our pursuit of happiness, we do bad things as a consequence of that pursuit. But other times in our pursuit of happiness, we do good things. Somebody is kind towards us and we are kind back because we understand that that is the right thing to do. And then we feel good as a consequence of that. So as a consequence of the avidya, we do good acts and we do bad acts. Now, the important point here, what this is all about, is that every time you make a choice, actually, I should go back to the very first factor again. Because one other aspect that comes into this equation now, another aspect of ignorance, another aspect of this delusion that is also very profoundly Buddhist way of looking at the world, is this sense that we have inside of us, each one of us, which may be true, it may be wrong, from a Buddhist point of view it is wrong, but the sense that we are the agent in our life. Right? The feeling, I am the agent, I am the chooser, I am the one who intends, I plan, I aim for things, I have purposes in this existence. You are that agent, right? This is the feeling we have. And this is one of those delusions from a Buddhist point of view that we cannot avoid. It is part and parcel of being an ordinary human being in this world. So what does that mean? If you think in a very profound way that you are this doer, what does that actually mean? Well, what it means is that when you make a choice in life, you have to own that choice. You have to take responsibility for it, right? If you are the agent and then you do an act, you have to take responsibility for that. You have no choice because it's you. So when you do something that is kind towards somebody else, something nice, it means that you have to take responsibility for that kindness. You are responsible for that kindness. You know in your heart, it's perhaps a wrong knowing, that's what I'm saying, it's a wrong knowing perhaps, but you feel in your heart, I am responsible for that kind act that I just did before. And because you feel responsible, you will notice that when you do an act that is truly kind, you often feel a sense of joy inside of you. I'm sure many of you here have felt that, right? Sometimes you just want to be kind. It comes out of your heart absolutely naturally. And when you do that, the joy comes inside of you. The mind brightens up, right? You feel a sense of energy because there's something very powerful about those acts of kindness. You own it. I did it, right? Because I did it. The happiness comes as a consequence. But the downside of that is that, of course, if you own the choices in your life, because you are trapped by this delusion of being the doer or being the agent behind all of these things, if you do something bad, you have to take responsibility for that as well, right? And so when you do something bad, what you are doing, you cannot avoid saying, I did that bad act. There is no such thing as doing something bad and kind of just shrugging it off and kind of moving on. It's impossible, because by the very nature of the way things are, there will be some sense of responsibility inside of you that you did that bad act. Right? So what is happening here is that as we go through life, as we make our choices, sometimes doing kind things, sometimes doing bad things, we are either lifting our mind up every time we do something good, or we are kind of suppressing our mind, pressing it down, holding it down by doing bad acts. So what this means is that if we accumulate a large number of good acts, we have to take responsibility for all those good acts. And your mind is starting to soar, right? It becomes very powerful, very light, very beautiful, very energetic. And the exact opposite happens. If you accumulate a lot of bad things, you're pushing your mind down more and more and more. So this is the balance sheet of karma, the amount of good things you do compared to the amount of good things, bad things compared to the amount of good things you do, will decide roughly, like the level, if you like. Level is just a metaphorical usage here, but the level of your mind, meaning the qualities that you have inside of you, will be this balance sheet of good things, because you are responsible, you feel responsible for those things. Right? So this is basically how karma works. And I would recommend you to actually try to feel this in your own life, because this is actually possible to feel for yourself. Feel. One day you feel really good, right? You feel everybody is your friend, you love the whole world. You know what it's like sometimes. Everything is wonderful, right? And you go out and you just want to be kind, do kind things to other people. And then you say something kind and you feel even more joyful as a consequence. Well, sometimes it just kind of, you don't necessarily feel all that great, but still, you know the importance of kindness. You do an act of kindness anyway, and then you feel the joy that comes from that. Notice that. Because what you are noticing when you see that, you're seeing how karma works right here in the present life. This is karma in action. It's called ditteva dhamma karma, the karma that refers to this very existence right here, right now. You can feel that for yourself, right? And when you see that, you start to see the power of action, the power of choice, and how it actually, either how it can lift your mind up and make you into a more beautiful person. When I say beautiful, I mean a person that it feels much better for you to be inside that person. You just feel much better about everything in the world. And of course, also notice what happens when you do something bad. Because you will see that when you do something bad, when you say something to somebody that isn't kind, sometimes all you have to do is to have a bad thought, and straight away you can feel like there's a loss of energy there. There is, the mind is becoming less bright, the mind has less happiness, you're destroying the beauty of the mind itself. So again, feel that. When you become upset with somebody, it's so easy to focus on the object of your upset. I don't like this person, they did something bad. Don't focus on the person. Feel how that upset inside of you, or that action that you do, how that affects your mind. And when you see that it suppresses you, it drags you down, it makes you feel terrible, you're understanding the effects of bad karma straight away in this very life. And it becomes a very powerful source, a very powerful motivation to do good, because you see how you're hurting yourself by doing what is not good in this world. Being unkind, you may hurt the other person a little bit, right? Perhaps you won't hurt them at all, it's very hard to know, but you will know straight away that you're hurting yourself. If you want a motivation in life to really support you in doing good acts, if you see how it hurts yourself, wow, it's a very, very powerful motivation. So this is one way I would encourage you to reflect on karma, because it becomes a very beautiful and practical way of looking at the world and dealing with the world. And then as you go through life, you will see as you go through life that if you live life in a good way, your consciousness is being raised, right? And because your consciousness is being raised, it's like it's moving up to a new level, a new platform at which it wasn't before. And then, because it has reached this platform, this becomes like the stable platform of your consciousness, it means, with the idea of rebirth, it means that when you pass away, that is where your next level of consciousness will be, right? So because you have lifted yourself up, you will actually continue at a new level of consciousness in your next life as well. That is how that rebirth process goes, how the you can feel the karma in this very life, and then how it transfers from this life also into the future life as well. You're lifting yourself up in this life, and because you have lifted yourself up, it continues like that into the future. Or if you are silly, if you don't live your life well, maybe because of bad friendships or whatever it is, you suppress yourself down and you feel bad, you don't feel happy, you feel miserable, then when you die, you may continue at that lower level of consciousness, right? And then you will have a rebirth which is less happy in the future. Or you just stay at the same level and kind of, you know, don't go anywhere, like many, many people probably do. So this is how this process works. And if you maybe what would be useful is just to go back to the beginning again, go back to this idea of avijja again, ignorance. Now, one of the important things to understand about this avijja, this ignorance, this delusion, this lack of understanding of reality, is that it is not a static thing. It's not something that is always exactly the same. Avijja, the lack of understanding of reality, is itself something that fluctuates throughout the day, throughout the years, throughout the months. It's not a static entity that is always the same. And the thing that influences this avijja, or lack of understanding, is the five hindrances. Five hindrances, very core concept of Buddhism again. The two most important one are desires, and the second one is anger, right? Anger and desires. These are the main things that influence your level of avijja. So what that means is that if you deal with those five hindrances, if you deal with your anger and desires in the world, and you are able to reduce those, you are already, by that fact, reducing your lack of understanding of the world. You're starting to see things more clearly just by reducing anger and desire. You have less avijja, right? Now, if you have less avijja, that means that you're seeing things more clearly. It means that now, instead of pursuing things that are, that may not be much happiness at all. You think they're happiness, but actually there aren't much happiness. Before, maybe you kind of went into the world seeking lots of power and money and all these kind of things. But then you realize, actually, maybe there isn't that much happiness to be found there. Because your desire and anger has been reduced, you see things more clearly. You sit down in meditation. You find a sense of real peace and contentment. And you actually understand that the real happiness in the world can be found just by sitting down, crossing your legs, watching your breath. Much more happiness in that than having a big bank account. Okay, maybe my priorities have been slightly wrong. Maybe I should reorganize my priorities, right? Heading in another direction. Very interesting. And of course, what happens when you see that, once you have one profound experience like that, of a much more of a different order of happiness than you had before, it changes your will, your volition, your aim, your purpose in life changes. And because your purpose in life changes, this is again the sankhara, the volition, the intention has changed. Because your volition has changed, you start doing things in a different way. So your consciousness level is also increased, because you now start to act on that new understanding of happiness instead of the wrong understanding you had before. You're producing more happiness as a consequence. And in this way, by reducing avijja, it feeds in to your purpose and aim in life, and then that feeds into the level of consciousness, which then is increased and lifted up as a consequence. That, of course, also then has further implications down the line, also for the idea of rebirth itself in the future. So this is how this process works. If you get it wrong, and you kind of go around in the world, and instead of decreasing the desires and anger, you increase them, right? Then it's the opposite things happen. Your volition, your aim in life is driven by that even more profound misunderstanding. And as a consequence, you make even more foolish decisions that you have to own, that you have to take responsibility for, and you are dragging yourself down as a consequence. So this is the idea of kamma, the idea that you have no choice but to take responsibility for the things in your life. You think you are the doer because you think you are the agency. Your responsibility has to be yours at the end of the day. And because of that, what we do matters enormously. It matters incredibly, because we cannot escape this unless we start doing the good and avoiding the bad. Of course, you will often hear in Buddhist circles that if you do something bad, you should forgive yourself, right? You should learn about forgiving yourself. People often ask, but how do I forgive myself? How do I do that? People find it hard, right? And one reason why it is hard is precisely because we feel we have to take ownership of these things. But one way of forgiving yourself is to start to use this Buddhist idea that actually, perhaps this will, perhaps the volition inside of you, perhaps the choices you make, perhaps they aren't as much you as you think they are. Perhaps a large part of these choices actually are conditioned, right? Perhaps our choices aren't really so much ours, but they are influenced by all kinds of phenomena inside of us and also outside of us. And this, if you really want to forgive yourself, this is one of the most powerful things that you have to do. So you start to look at your life. Why did you choose certain things? Why did you do certain things in a certain way? And often the more distance you have to things that happened in the past, the more clear it becomes that actually a very large portion of that choice was actually conditioned by external or internal phenomena over which you didn't really have much choice at all. So the choice itself starts to look as if it has less and less to do and more to do with all these other conditions around you. So this is the way to understand it, basically. And of course, if you are able to start to see yourself as a victim of the causality in the world, external conditions coming to you, internal conditions coming, and shaping your choice, shaping who you are, not only can you forgive yourself, but it also becomes possible to forgive other people. This is so important, right? I'm always horrified when I see how vengeful people sometimes are. People are sometimes so vengeful. You read in the paper, this person deserves to go to jail, this person deserves to be, you know, killed or whatever it is because of their activities. But the more you understand that we are shaped by circumstances and nature around us, the less willing you will be to affect this kind of retribution other people, because you understand that they too are shaped by the circumstances, they too are shaped by conditions, and then you can start to forgive. You can forgive yourself, and you can also forgive the world around you. But the point I'm making here tonight is that even if you can forgive yourself to a large extent, and certainly please learn to forgive yourself, it's a very powerful thing. I think the volume went down a little bit again, but hopefully you can hear me. It's a very wonderful thing to do, to be able to forgive yourself and forgive others. But there will always be a residue of responsibility. There will always be a residue of you having to own the act. You will never be able to forgive yourself 100%. And the reason for that is because you haven't yet penetrated, you haven't yet fully understood the idea that you are not responsible for those acts. In the end, all those acts come from causes and conditions, and then when you see that fully one day, only then will you be able to forgive yourself 100%. Does that ever happen? According to Buddhism, it does. One day you have very profound insight. This is what is often called stream entry in Buddhism. And stream entry means having a full understanding of the mind and the conditionality of the mind. And one of the powerful things about stream entry is you see yourself as a conditioned being. And when you understand that, you have the ability to forgive yourself one absolutely completely for anything you do. And this is why the stream mentor never in the future always has happy consequences happening to them after they get that attainment. There's no more possibility for them to drag themselves down into in this life or in future lives, because you understand the nature of that conditionality. Sounds good, doesn't it? You want to become a stream mentor? Complete forgiveness, forgive yourself, forgive everybody else, forgive the whole world, forgive the most terrible tyrants that have existed in human history, right? You can do that because you understand that even they were the victims of their own conditionality. We are victims of conditionality, right? We're not really responsible at the end of the day. It's a very, very powerful idea. But we still feel responsibility. And as long as you feel responsible, you have to do what is right. You have to do what is good, because you always will be the owner of those actions. You will either lift yourself up or you will drag yourself down as a consequence of what you do. Okay. So that is my little talk on dependent origination and karma. This evening, I don't think I will elaborate any more on that. I hope it made a little bit of sense to you. This is quite profound, these subjects, but I personally always feel that when you get a grasp on these things, they become incredibly meaningful. When you start to feel what these things actually mean, then they become so much more meaningful in your life, and you can start to act accordingly. Okay. Okay, so let us, there is supposed to be some lion dancing later on, so we still have a bit of time before the lion dancers arrive. So are there any questions or comments or anything? Yes, over here. Is there a microphone maybe? Yeah, great.
What purpose is there in whatever power is behind enlightenment, in having us feel over which we have no control?
Ah, okay. What is the purpose in that? Well, I think the way the Buddha explains these things, the way that whole Buddhist teachings is oriented, is not really oriented towards explaining the whys of the world, the way, you know, the why things are in a certain way, or why things are in aren't in a different way. Because that is really the realm of philosophy, you know, explaining the universe, why the universe is expanding, or why there's so much suffering in the world, all this kind of stuff. The Buddha's approach is much more pragmatic. The Buddha's approach is saying, well, listen, there is a problem here. This is the way that you work as a human being. This is the problem inside of you. This is how it is solved. This is really how the Buddha works. So he explains as much as is necessary to explain, to put you on the right track, to aim you in the right direction, and then you go on as a consequence. It's like this whole thing actually is quite interesting, this whole thing about, you know, you often get asked as a Buddhist monk, what is Buddhism, right? Some people say it's a philosophy, some people say it's psychology, some people say it's a religion, some people say it's nonsense, right? There's all kinds of things, right? But one of the questions is Buddhism a philosophy? That's one of the important questions, I think. Is it really a philosophy? Similes that you find that the Buddha would often use in the discourses, that one of the similes this was in a place called the Gosinga wood, and he would take up a handful of leaves and he would say to his monks or his nuns or the lay people or whoever was there, he would say, what is more, the leaves in my hand or the leaves in the forest, right? So it's obviously a no-brainer, and the monks would, of course, comply, yes, the leaves in your hands are few and the ones in the forest are many, right, obviously. But the Buddha was making an important point, and the point he was making was that, well, the leaves in my hand are equivalent to what I have taught you, because what I have taught you is those things that lead you away from suffering, leads you out of the problem that you have, leads you to happiness. That's what I've taught you. The stuff in the forest is all the things I know, I haven't taught you, because it isn't helpful in that regard. So what is all that stuff in the forest? Well, it's all kind of truths about the world, right? A philosophy, if you like, an understanding, maybe more like a scientific understanding of how the universe operates. But it isn't directly relevant to the purpose of finding the solution to these things. So why didn't Buddha teach that? You know, when I read, I think, wow, that would be really interesting, really exciting, right, to understand all of these things and compare in modern science to see if the Buddha got it right or modern science got it right and how it all compares, right? Wow, that would be really cool. And instead of having like 20 volumes, we'd have 2,000 volumes that we could read, right? And that is the problem, right? That is precisely the problem. The problem is that in the realm of philosophy, there is no end. It just goes on and on and on. And once you start to elaborate on a certain philosophy, others will challenge you and say, what? You can't say that. That is obviously wrong. And you will have to, even if you know you're right, you will have to defend yourself, right? And other people will say, well, you haven't explained it completely. It has to be expanded on. So then you get the commentaries, another 2,000 volumes of commentaries. That's roughly how it works, actually. So it's not a joke. And so it goes on and on and on. And I think the Buddha, this is my personal take on this, he didn't actually say this, I think the Buddha foresaw the danger of philosophizing too much, that philosophizing too much actually tends to lead you away, because we love philosophizing, right? We love to think things out, we love to consider things, and it's so easy to get sidetracked by that. And if you look at the history of Buddhist thought, that is exactly what happened. The Buddha didn't philosophize, but as soon as the Buddha passed away, what happened? Philosophizing started to come into vogue, right? And one of the first major works of philosophy that got written, or it wasn't written, it was orally, that got produced, if you like, or created after the Buddha's passed away, the first major work of philosophy was the Abhidhamma. That is philosophy. The Abhidhamma, you may never heard of it before, but the Abhidhamma is now regarded as canonical. Many people say it's the word of the Buddha. I can't comprehend how it possibly could be the word of the Buddha. I have read these things, right? I read these things in the original language, which was Pali. I know how they compare. They are very different texts, use different vocabulary, completely different ideas. It is very obvious that it is a later historical development when you read it. So for me, it is obvious anyway that it's not the word of the Buddha. So once you start reading that, you start to notice that this is like a division of reality into units, right? Just like science says, all these different kind of atoms, right? Different, you have the periodic table nicely arranged. This is a bit like the periodic table, the Buddhist periodic table. You have the 28 material phenomena, you have the 70 whatever mental phenomena, all nicely classified, right? This is one book of the Abhidhamma, and then there's another book of the Abhidhamma called the it's called the Patthana. The Patthana shows you how all of these phenomena relate to each other here. So because there are so many ways these phenomena can relate to each other, and because there are so many phenomena, this book is literally absolutely enormous. In the present form that we have it, the Patthana is only a couple of volumes longer. But there was an English monk, he's living in Sri Lanka now, and he calculated that. It has all these ellipsis points, right, dot, dot, dot in there, kind of, because it's too much to write everything out. So it has all these dot, 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 dots in the book. But he calculated, if I fill in all the dots, how big will this book actually become, right? And what he figured out is that if he, there's only two volumes now, but if I fill in all these dots in between, it starts to expand and expand and expand. And he figured out that the distance, the length of this book would roughly be the distance between Sydney and Melbourne. That would be the size of that book, right? How far is that? About 800 kilometers or something, right? So it is 800 kilometer wide book from spine, to, you know, from the width of the spine is 800 kilometers. So, and this is philosophy, and this is the problem with philosophy. It's endless. It goes on and on and on. And then if you look at even later Buddhism, you find things like the mind-only school, right? Mind-only school sounds like philosophy, right? Mind-only school is obviously a philosophical position. Of course, there are practical implications, but it's rooted in philosophical ideas that deal with idealism or mind-only. So this is the problem with Buddhism. And I think often it is good to go back. It's not only good, it's apt that we go back to the early sources of Buddhism and that we understand that the Buddha was a very pragmatic and practical teacher. He saw that there is a problem. He saw that there is a solution to this problem. And that is what he taught us. And it's only in later generations that he started to expand on this, precisely because the mind proliferates. This is called papancha in Pali. The mind proliferates. The mind loves to think, to create castles in the air, right? This is what the mind loves to do. That is exactly what happened. Let us try to heed the word of the Buddha rather than heeding the word of later generations and starting to philosophize too much. Anyway, that's a long answer to your question. But it's interesting, right? I find these things fascinating. So that's why I talk about that a little bit.
Don't have faith, have experience.
Right. Well, this is another thing. A lot of philosophizing is about faith very often, right? It's rests on certain assumptions. So this is another part of which I think is very important. Yeah. Okay. Anyone else who would like to say something here? Anyone who would like to say nothing? You are very welcome as well here. But,
some questions from overseas.
Okay, excellent. Yeah. Okay, before we start with overseas, anybody else like to say something here? His last chance, any hands? Nobody? Okay, so let's see what they have to say from overseas then here. Okay, this is from Malta, from Christine in Malta. If dependent origination is related to causality, how does awareness about causality, causality and effect of events help us cope with life? Does it alleviate suffering without eliminating it? So how does the understanding of causality help us in life? How does it? The thing about Buddha's teaching is that it is through and through a teaching about causality. Everything in Buddhism is causal, right? This is the idea, no things that is always present. Everything is causal. So understanding causality is incredibly important. The causality of dependent arising can also be important if it is applied in a good way, like the way I was talking about today. But one of the ways that I would recommend people to apply understanding of causality is to apply it to the problems in life, the things that you want to overcome, right? If you want to overcome the anger in life, if you want to overcome excessive desires in life, then to understand the causality behind those things will help you to eliminate them. Right? This is so important because in the end, the Buddhist path is a path of purification. The Visuddhimagga is not the book, right? The book Visuddhimagga. The Visuddhimagga is the real teaching of the Buddha. That's the Visuddhimagga. That book is later stuff. The real Visuddhimagga is the teaching of the Buddha. So, Eightfold Path is the Visuddhimagga, the path of purification. So because we're trying to purify ourselves, because we're how can we reduce anger? How can we reduce confusion, right? All of these things. Why do people get angry? What is the reason for that? And the reason is because you are the way you are focusing on a particular object. If you look at a person and you see all the faults in that person, right? If you see this person, oh, they are really, these are a really nasty fellow, you know, is really really making my life miserable, this person. If you think like that, you're going to get upset with the person. If you think, wow, this person really has some problems, right? They have all this conditioning in them that make them difficult to be around. Actually, they are the one who have the problem, not me. I feel a bit sorry for them. I have a bit of compassion for them, a bit of sympathy, because actually the problem is theirs. The problem is not mine at all. So you understand that they probably don't want to be like that. They are like that because their own cause and conditions in their life. And then instead, you look at the good qualities, right? And when you see somebody's good qualities rather than the bad ones, then you have metta, compassion, loving kindness, instead of having negativity. So this is how you use the idea of causality to move yourself away from these negative states. Dependent arising is sometimes a little bit too theoretical, but this is very, very practical, dependent causality. And this is why when you go to the famous Satipatthana Sutta, the four focuses of mindfulness, is four applications, you find that the idea of understanding the five hindrances and understanding causality is a core aspect of that sutta, because precisely it helps us to change ourselves as human beings. Okay, so I hope that helps Christine in Malta. It's pretty cool that we get Malta right in here in our little suburb here in Perth in Western Australia. That's really nice. So anyway, I hope you get something out of that. Move on to the next one, which is Siu Hua from Penang. And you say that regarding the Vedana factor that comes after the contact factor, is that something we have control over, or is it pre-programmed from previous conditioning? Okay, what Sihua is referring to is that I was saying before, right? I said beginning we have avidya, lack of understanding. Then we have all this agency, this established in a certain level because of that. Because consciousness is established at a certain level, we tend to experience the world in a certain way. If consciousness is low, we in a bad way. If consciousness is high, we experience the world in a good way. This is called nama rupa. This means mental and material phenomena. We are aware of the world. We experience the world around us. And that experiencing is called contact. Every time we see something, we hear something, we are contacting the world, right? You know what I mean? It's like a contact. We are kind of in touch with the world, quite literally. Yeah? And from that contact, when I see something, I feel something. Either it's pleasant or it's unpleasant or it's neutral, right? So when I see everybody here tonight, I feel quite happy, right? I see all the nice people coming to the Buddha Society. What a wonderful thing that is, when we all come together and do something good. So it makes me feel quite good. And the atmosphere in here is nice. We know that lion dancing is going to happen soon. For some people that's good, for some people it's not so good because it destroys a little bit of the peace and quiet. But anyway, it's all meant in good fun. So once you have contact, you have to feel as a consequence of contact in the world. So the question is here, does that contact automatically mean that feeling is pre-programmed as a consequence of contact? And the answer to that is no. And I'm a bit worried now to get too carried away into kind of deeper aspects of dependent arising, but just taking the chance that this it will be okay for everybody, and please don't walk out in anger or anything like that if you don't understand what's going on. It's not that complicated actually, but the idea is that when you contact the world, that contact happens through two faculties, in two through a process which is twofold. When you see something, first of all, the eye has to be there, right? If you don't have an eye, you won't see anything here, right? So this is number one. You have to have an eye. The whole visual apparatus, the eye, the nerves, the brain, all that stuff has to be there for you to be able to contact the world. But the second thing that you have to be able to contact the world is the mind. The mind has to process that sight, right? So when the mind processes the sight, the actual mind state you are in will affect how that sight is processed. You know what it's like? You get up in the morning, right? You're feeling great. Everybody is your friend. Even your worst enemies are your friends on that particular day. And when you see them, you feel happy rather than miserable, right? The mind state you are in changes, alters the object. The next day you feel absolutely miserable. You come out of the bed, you know, getting up on the wrong side of bed or whatever it's called, right? Feeling really, really bad. And everybody is just, wow, yuck. This is a really bad day, right? So then you meet even your best friend, right? Let alone your enemy. And that enemy looks absolutely terrible on that day. So this is what I mean by the mind state you have affects how you see the world, how you hear the world, how you think about the world. So contact leading to a sight is very, very dependent on the mind state you have. And some people, if you are very kind of down and sad and depressed, everything can look terrible. But for somebody who is very happy and positive, everything can look beautiful and bright. And it's exactly the same thing that they are seeing. It's the same object, but how you interpret it is incredibly different. So the mind is very, very important on how we experience the world through contact. But this is another aspect of dependent arising, right? This is what I said, it's such of insight, this dependent arising. There's so much to it that maybe we're going to have to give more talks about that in the future. Okay, I'm almost to the last question quickly. This is from Paul in the UK. What is a practical way in terms of knowledge of dependent origination to help balance out past bad actions from the mind? Okay, so in terms of dependent origination, well, that is in the large part what I have been talking about tonight, right? The idea that if you do good, you are lifting up your mind. And it doesn't matter if you have done bad acts in the past, you still lift up your mind by doing good. And this is a very famous simile that many of you will have heard before, probably, the simile of the lump of salt. It's a very nice simile. If you have a little lump of salt, right, this is a symbol for your bad karma, the bad actions you have done. And then you have a glass of water. If you put, the amount of water is a symbol for the good karma. If you put that salt into the glass of water, oh, can't drink it. It's really, really salty, absolutely terrible. You have very bitter results from your bad karma if you have only done a small amount of good karma. If you take the same amount of salt, you put it in a large basin of water, right? Even a pond. In the sutta, it says the river Ganges. River Ganges, if you've been there, is absolutely humongous. It's this enormous river. It's about 2 kilometers wide around the Patna area. It's this enormous thing. So you put the salt in there, you try to drink it, you don't feel anything. Or if you feel something, it's a tiny, tiny bit. Because now the amount of water shows you have made enormous amounts of good karma, and the same amount of bad karma hardly makes any effect on you at all. That's the Buddha's simile for showing you how bad karma doesn't get destroyed, but it gets diluted by your bad karma. You're still lifting up your mind, and you're no longer allowing the bad karma from the past to hold you down. You soar up, right? You soar up. You're starting to cut off the sandbags that are holding you down. You're inflating the balloon with more helium. And as the helium gets more, the balloon gets lighter and lighter. And you're soaring, soaring. And you get this beautiful, the mind becomes light and bright and energetic. And at the same time, you get the bird's eye view of the world. And that, of course, is where the insights can come from, because you're seeing from above, for a mind which is light, bright, and beautiful, and standing above everything else. So, anyway, that's a little bit of answer to Paul. So I hope you're happy with that. Now it is 9 o'clock, and I have been told that the lines are supposed to be... So I don't know, I can't see any lines. Maybe that's a good thing, I can't see any lines. is there... I can go on for a little bit longer if you like. Oh!
You're on the way.
On their way. Okay. What is, that's what they always say. They're on their way, right? And okay. Would you like to ask any more questions while we're sitting here so that we don't get too noisy or too much moving around? Anything else you would like to bring up while we're here? Everybody's happy. Okay. Maybe we can just do the... should we do that? We should do that afterwards, actually. Okay, we'll just chill and wait for the lions and see what happens.